What do kids in Finland, Poland, and South Korea learn that American kids just don't? Annie Murphy-Paul joins us to talk about the smartest kids in the world, this week's cover review.
What it comes down to is not resources, but what Amanda calls a culture of rigor that we're lacking in this country and that other countries have effectively instilled in their students.
Who gets to keep a child? The parents who brought him into this world or those who tend to him? Chris Beam is here to talk about To the End of June, the intimate life of American foster care.
Foster care is changing. It's a really vibrant and vital kind of world. It's not this sort of fait accompli, like, oh, it's a mess and it's stuck.
Our new children's book editor, Sarah Harrison Smith, is here to talk about what to read during that roller coaster period known as back to school. Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Parle Sagel will tell us about this week's bestsellers. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Our cover review this week is of a new book by Amanda Ripley, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. Here to talk about it is our reviewer, Annie Murphy-Paul, no relation. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Pamela.
So this is perfect timing for a book like this when all of us parents are either panicking over or very eager to get our kids back into school or a combination of both. What is the argument of this book?
Well, it's also perfect timing because there's been a lot of recent reports about how poorly American students are doing relative to students in other countries. And so Amanda Ripley's approach to examining why that's the case was to follow three American students, as they went to Poland, South Korea, and Finland, which are three countries that have done very well in international rankings, and to use those students as what she calls field agents to sort of penetrate these other cultures and these other school systems and bring back a report of what they're doing right with the idea that we can learn from them.
Why didn't she talk to kids who were from those countries and say, pick a Finnish student and a Polish student and a South Korean, as opposed to having someone from America who'd already been totally screwed up by our system go in there for a year?
Well, I think she thought that by following the exploits of these three students who were actually in those schools every day, interacting with the other students as peers and not as some reporter coming in from outside, and as students who'd had, as you say, experiences already with the American school system, that they would be in the best position to compare and contrast their different experiences and to share those with Amanda. And she, Amanda did also interview classmates of the students that she followed. But really, the heart of the book is the experiences that these American students have. And I say in the review, it's really written in the best tradition of travel writing. It's as much a travel book as an education book, because it's really startling to see how differently things are done in schools in other countries.
That brings me to another question I had, which is, why these three countries? Did Amanda know that she was going to do these three countries and then she found students who were already going? Or was she sort of part of the process of convincing some poor high school sophomore to, like, Finland for you? Or how did that work?
No, she found students who were already on their way to these countries, but she very deliberately picked those three countries. Finland, because they have really risen to the top of the international rankings.
Are they higher than the rest of Scandinavia?
They are higher than the rest of Scandinavia, yeah. And she wanted to find out why.
Sweden isn't perfect in all things after all.
No, Finland is the reigning champion. Then she wanted to look at Korea because they have a somewhat different model, a very pressure-driven, test-driven kind of model that does produce high test scores, but as she writes in the book, also produces a lot of misery along the way, which is not the case for Finland. It really seemed like Finland was the one that had gotten it right. And then Poland is not quite as high in the international rankings as the other two, but it's made a lot of progress in a very short time. So she wanted to look at how that had happened.
Now, I'm also curious about, like, when we say the international rankings, sort of who is the body that decides, you know, this country is ranked higher than this country, and what's the basis that they do this on? Because I would think that the testing methods are very different from country to country.
Yes. Well, Amanda opens her book actually with an account of the guy who created these international tests. They're called PISA. You'll have to read the book for the exact details of the organization and the test. But it's pretty consistent that that American students land in the middle of those rankings. And we can point to, you know, the high levels of poverty among American students, but there are poor students in other countries as well. It seems to be what it comes down to is not resources, but what Amanda calls a culture of rigor that we're lacking in this country and that other countries have effectively instilled in their students.
Because, I mean, in America, so much of the conversation when you're comparing one public school, because our education system is so much about the local level, there's a lot of variation in terms of how much funding each student gets. And so there's always this debate of, like, this private school versus a public school and this, you know, tiny dirt poor town to this Tony, you know, Westchester suburb, and how much money is spent per student. Did Amanda look at those equations and compare what the spending was on a student basis in the different countries, or was that sort of just not part of what she was researching?
There was a very interesting scene from her reporting in Finland in which she talked to a teacher whose classroom was filled with immigrant students, many of them poor, as a kind of comparison to some of the struggles that American teachers face in the inner city. This teacher said something very interesting. He said, "I try not to think too much about my students' background. I don't want to feel sorry for them. I want," I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "I want to feel that each of them has as much of a chance to do well as any other student," which is quite different from a lot of the conversation that we have around poverty and education in America, which suggests that some students are just not going to do as well as others, that we really have to take their socioeconomic background into account, even that we have to solve poverty before we can solve the problems that afflict our schools. This teacher was saying, no, every student is expected to meet these high standards, and I don't want to think about their backgrounds in a way that would incline me to not give them that chance.
So you're in the process of reading and writing your own book on a kind of related topic. Was there something that you learned in this book that really kind of was news to you and informed your own thinking?
Well, my book is very research-based. It's looking at the cognitive science and psychology of learning. And I was interested to see a lot of what the scientific literature shows is really confirmed or supported by what Amanda found in her book. For example, you know, we have so much focus in this country on technology and educational technology and how that's the key to improving school outcomes. And Amanda found that this sort of techno enthusiasm is not universal. And in fact, in the school that she reported on in Finland, for example, there were no interactive whiteboards, there were no iPads, there were no laptops, but there were very bright, dedicated, hardworking teachers. Not that we don't have those in America as well, but Amanda pointed out that those teachers had to meet the highest standards to even apply to schools of education. And then they had been very rigorously trained and supported, and that the teaching was what made the difference. And they didn't need all the sort of technological gadgets to try to make up for something that wasn't there. So I think that's supported by a lot of what the scientific literature is showing. So I did draw some connections between my own work and between and Amanda's book.
Are the teachers in these other countries getting paid more? Are the professions more respected than they are in America?
I'm not sure about the answer to that first question. I think that the answer to the second question is yes. Teachers seem to be more respected in these other countries. Partly because of the standards that are enforced for entering the profession. Teachers have to be the best of the best, the cream of the crop, to become teachers. So that naturally leads to a greater prestige and a greater respect accorded the profession.
To go back to the technology and the difference between Finland's approach, not only with the more dedicated teachers, but is the pedagogy more about experiential learning or hands-on than it is about using the latest technology? Or is there a difference in terms of the way they teach?
You know, it seemed that the difference really lay in the commitment that teachers had to making sure that every student was doing well, every student was understanding the material, and also the commitment that the students had. There's this great scene in the book that I write about in the review where the Kim, the girl from Oklahoma who travels to Finland to be an exchange student, says in wonderment or asks in total genuine curiosity, asks two Finnish girls, why do you care so much about school? Because that was what she noticed as a difference between her school back in America and her school, the school in Finland, was that the students really cared. Every one of them, even the stoners, she said, made it to class and seemed to care about doing well. And
they went to class high, but they were there.
They were there. They were doing their work. And the two girls were, the Finnish girls, were baffled by her question. And finally, one of them said, well, it's school. How else, if I don't do well, how else am I going to go to university and get a good job? And of course, that's the only sensible answer to Kim's question. And yet, in America, we don't have this culture of rigor necessarily around school. We haven't realized that education is the only way for us to be globally competitive. And so a lot of kids are skating through school or even dropping out of school.
You're a parent of two school-aged children. In reading this book, did you come away with it and think, like, wow, I wish that, you know, in America we were like South Korea in X respect or like Finland or Poland?
Mm. Well, you definitely don't come away from Ripley's book wishing that your students went to a school in Korea, because it's, she makes it clear, she calls it the hamster wheel model, where these kids are literally sleeping through class because they're so exhausted because they studied all night at these outside of school tutoring companies where the cramming for the very rigorous end of school exams happens. And no one's loving school. Everyone seems to loathe it, but they know that the test determines basically everything about their future. So I think you wouldn't want your child to be a student in Korea, but Poland and Finland look pretty good, especially when Ripley draws a comparison between their focus on academics, their relentless, rigorous focus on academics, and the way that American students' energies are often dissipated. And here I'll show my own bias on sports, for example. This is a point that Ripley returns to a few times, that sports are a huge part of American culture and obviously and of American high schools, and yet they really have nothing to do with how well a student is going to survive and prosper in life after school. And she, the wonder of her book is that she manages to turn the lens on our own culture and our own choices and make that look just very, very strange and kind of indefensible. If what we're supposed to be doing is preparing our kids for a ruthlessly competitive global economy, it doesn't make sense that most of their energy is going to football.
Okay, so it sounds like less football, less computers, perhaps less relentless cramming at night, and we'll all be a lot happier and smarter. Annie Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book again is The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way by Amanda Ripley, reviewed on this week's cover by Annie Murphy Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, a novel written and read by the late David Rakoff. That's Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. What's going on in the publishing world, Julie?
A lot is going on despite the dog days of August, but this week there was a very interesting development in book club world. The Today Show, which is the second-rated morning show on network TV, announced that it would do a new monthly book club. So this is a very positive development for publishers who are always saying that there are fewer and fewer places on TV to promote their authors.
It's a rare bit of good news.
So this book club, of course, reminded many people in the industry about the Oprah Book Club, which has been revived as of last year in a diminished form. It doesn't have the weekday talk show that Oprah used to have to promote it. But the Today Show, a lot of publishers hope, will be something similar to that. It's a show that is watched by a lot of book readers, obviously a very heavily female audience, a lot of people who read a lot of fiction and like book clubs and are always looking for what to read next. So this is a show that, you know, does have authors on frequently, but it's usually authors who are tied into the news in some way, nonfiction. And the producers of the new book club said that they believe that they would focus a lot on fiction, which was very good news for publishers.
Now, it's interesting because the Today Show, there was some bad news a couple years ago when they, for the first time, stopped having the Caldecott and Newbery Award winners on the show and had Snooki instead. So maybe this signifies a shift in direction for them.
Yes, and I'm sure everyone listening right now is shuddering at the memory of that because, as you know, the Newbery and Caldecott are two of the biggest awards in literature, for children's literature. And for people who count on that spot every year to have those authors on the show and to be replaced by Snooki, who is promoting a novel under her name that she obviously didn't write, was a real blow and an insult to people who really count on this. So I think that this is one way for the Today Show to kind of position itself as the more substantive morning show. Good Morning America, which has been in the number one spot for several months now, is a little bit frothier, a little bit lighter. They certainly wouldn't have a book club that right. was very serious.
There's always a debate among authors and publishers as to which of the breakfast shows sort of has the most readers among their viewership.
Right. And, there are some newish venues on TV that have emerged in recent years. For at least 5 years now, The Daily Show, Comedy Central, The Colbert Report has a lot of authors on TV, and they're very consistent sellers of books.
And you don't have to wake up at the break of dawn.
No, you don't. You can stay up late or watch it whenever you want. But I think that a lot of publishers say that those shows are really good. And then, there are some morning shows. CBS Sunday Morning is a show that a lot of publicists have told me recently that, has great authors on the show. And they also have a lot of really, heavily, book buying audience.
Now, Al Roker on the Today Show has had a book club in the past, right?
He has.
Is that going to continue or is that going to morph into this?
Well, that is something that I think has dwindled in recent years. And the Today Show also had a separate book club that they started about 10, 12 years ago. But it really didn't last long. It faded away very quickly. And this was a time when Oprah had put her book club on hiatus after, being such a consistent promoter of books. She had called it quits on her book club. And all three morning shows on CBS, ABC, and NBC had started book clubs, hoping to kind of fill the void. But none of them did, even combined.
So what's the first lucky book?
So the first book is a debut novel called The Bone Season, which is by Samantha Shannon. She's a 21-year-old recent graduate of Oxford, and this is a dystopian novel that was acquired by Bloomsbury, and it's the first in a series, and Samantha Shannon has gotten a ton of buzz comparisons to J.K. Rowling in our own pages and, I believe, in the New York Magazine.
Is it YA or YA crossover? What's the...
It's not... technically YA, but it's one of those books that it almost doesn't matter if it's YA or if it's an adult novel. It's technically an adult novel, but I'm sure it'll be read by, you know, a lot of teenagers, and it's the definition of crossover.
All right. Well, a little less vegetable chopping then and more book reading on the Today Show. That sounds like good news. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Chris Beam is here to talk about her new book, To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So what inspired you to write this book? This is your third book.
I was inspired by a couple of things, but I used to be a public school teacher, and I took in a foster kid. She was a former student of mine, and I was shocked at the way she was treated, really, in foster care. I was shocked, really, by the way that the system that was designed to protect her actually did her harm. And what happened was she had been a student of mine, and they had told her that there were no more rooms, there were no more beds for her in the group home, so they were going to put her into juvenile hall. Just because they didn't have space for her.
What's the difference between a group home and a juvenile home?
Well, she hadn't committed a crime. Juvenile hall is for juvenile delinquents, okay, or kids that have committed crimes. A group home is just a place to hold kids. So when you're in foster care, you can either go into a family, right, with parents, or a single parent that takes you in temporarily until your biological parents can bring you back, or until you get adopted. When there aren't single families to take you in, there are group homes. They're sort of modern-day orphanages where people are paid in 8-hour shifts, basically, to watch over the kids. Often teenagers are put into group homes because there aren't enough families that want them. Ideally, kids would be put into families because that's the better place for them, where they can get love and nurturance.
And how old was this girl?
She was 17. She was 17, and they didn't have a space for her. So they said, well, we'll put her into juvenile hall. Now, juvenile hall is a place for kids that have committed crimes, and they're dangerous, and they deeply affect their self-esteem. And I said, that's outrageous. You can't put her into juvenile hall when she hadn't committed a crime. And they said, well, it'll get wiped off her record. What does it matter? As though she weren't a human being.
Is this New York State?
This is L.A. This was in Los Angeles. I was living in L.A. at the time. And I said, well, that's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. Come. And she called me really upset, saying, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go into juvenile hall. And I said, well, come. Stay with me. This is unbelievable. Here I was, I was only 28 at the time, thinking I'll go up against the system. You know, this can't be right. So I took her in, and then they ultimately called me and said, well, there is really nowhere else to put her. Do you want to take her? Do you want to be her guardian? And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'll be your guardian. And so that's really how it started. And through that process, I got really interested in how this system that was designed to protect children could do them such disservice.
Did you foster her until she aged out?
I fostered her beyond that. Once she came to me and once we got settled, and this happens a lot of times, as you know in your story, actually.
This is the story I did for the Times Magazine about a West Virginian couple who had fostered over 20 children.
Right. And so what happens often is the rules, the bureaucratic rules that are in place, often for very good reason. It's not like the system is evil, but there are rules set in place that don't necessarily match the kids' attachments. And when those two buck up against one another, you get a lot of trauma that's unnecessary. So once Christina, my daughter, came to me, and we had settled into a rhythm of sorts and set her up a bedroom and gotten her placed into a new school and fixed up her resume to get her a job, and we sort of built up a rhythm, her agency called and said, wait a minute, you're not a licensed foster parent. We just figured this out. We can't have her here. We have to remove her. And I said, well, wait a minute. What will it take to get me licensed? And they said, it'll take 10 weeks. So we're going to put her somewhere else. What we're going to do is we're going to put her into a home for sex offenders. And she was nowhere near a sex offender. And she panicked. She said, I'm running away. I'm going to run away to another. I'm going to run to Mexico.
And what's the problem? They don't have the space. Are the programs underfunded?
No. The thing with Christina is she's transgender. So they didn't have a place for her because they wanted to place her. She was assigned male at birth. So they wanted to place her with biological males. And that's dangerous for her. And because there's a lot of assault. So they don't place her there. So there's only one group home that might be safe for her. So what they do is they put her in these unsafe situations like juvenile hall or like a home for sex offenders, which is the last thing that she is. So she said, I'm going to run. According to the agency, they said, just put her there. you know, again, as though she's not a person with feelings, until you complete the 10-week course. So what we did was we found a friend who's a foster mom who would take her in until I could get licensed, but we didn't even bother with that. What we did was we on the books, we said that she was there, and then they didn't even check up on her. Within a day, she was back with me. So all we had to do was sign some papers saying she was there, and then she just came back.
And what does it mean to get licensed?
Well, the thing about licensure is that it's different in every city and state and county. That's the thing about foster care, is that it's really it's a hodgepodge of different systems. Really,
there's no national system of foster care.
No, I mean there's a federal sort of umbrella, and then within that there are all kinds of cities and counties do it in different ways. So some places require 10 hours, some places require 0 hours, some places require 50 hours, and some places require annual reuptakes. So it really depends on where you live. In New York, for example, it requires 10 weeks. In California, it requires 10 weeks. In New York, you can get an emergency license. So if a kid came to you and said, help, you could get an emergency license.
Now, with your foster daughter,
yeah.
How did she end up?
She's great.
A foster child.
Oh, how did she originally?
At 17.
She was seven mm-hmm. when she first was put into care because of abuse in the home. So she was taken out. It had nothing to do with her being trans, for example.
And had she been in and out of homes and families between that period of 7 to 17?
Yeah, so her mother's rights were never, her parental rights weren't terminated, so she wasn't available for adoption. So she did what a lot of kids do, which is that she went into care, she went into foster home, and then she went back to her biological mother's house. And then she was taken out again. When they suspected abuse, and then she would go back to her mother's house, and then she'd go out again. So she went back and forth and back and forth. And with each removal, you know, there was more trauma.
Now, this brings up a very big question, which I know you address in the book, which is, you know, who has the rights to the child? Is it the parent who brings the child into the world, but maybe a drug addict, maybe abusive, maybe incompetent, maybe unstable, maybe mentally disabled? Or is it the foster parent? And is there a national policy on this question, or how does that work?
It's really case by case, and it needs to be case by case. It's a really tricky question. And that's one of the things that I found in the book, is that each child is different and each family is different. And I think one of the things that we need to think about very deeply is the issue of removing kids. Often I think we remove kids far too quickly.
Isn't there just a horrible case? Was it in Texas?
Yeah.
Tell us about that story.
There was a case with a 2-year-old child who was removed because her parents were smoking marijuana, and she was put with one foster family, and the biological parents who had visitation saw bruises and thought she was being abused. So she was placed with another foster family, and that foster mother killed her.
So this foster mother who killed the 2-year-old, did she have a record? What was the...
Yeah, she had a record.
You have to wonder let's talk about these parents. I mean, there are obviously people who do this, you know, with a great amount of generosity and heart. I mean, it takes a lot to bring in a foster child who may have had a very troubled and difficult past into your own family, whether you have biological children or other children in the home or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's an incredible thing to do, but of course, not all foster parents are doing this necessarily for the right reasons or have the ability to handle.
You know, there's a real, again, we don't really have a national picture of who these parents are. Most of the studies are anecdotal or very small. We don't have a real picture, even of the basic demographics. You know, there's this sort of saying that foster parents do it for the money. And a lot of the parents I've met, that's certainly not true. The money is not great. And frankly, I think we need to pay more. There are certainly parents that do it for the money. And there are certainly parents that do it just out of sheer goodwill. And there are tremendous foster parents out there. And I think that there's a large clump right in the middle that are sort of the mediocre flatlands of foster care, where they are taught not to attach to the kids because the kids are going to go. They're taught to see the kids as interchangeable parts. You know, they're just kids that come in and they leave. And this is what I think, in my experience at least, really causes a sort of calcification in the kids, you know.
Right.
We never tell a person who's bereaved, you know, that's just lost his or her husband or wife or whatever, you know, your husband's just died, here's a new one, love him. But we say that to foster children every day. And then when they don't love back, They get sent back to the agency when they start wetting the bed. They get sent back to the agency when they kick and scream. They get sent back to the agency. That kid hardens, and then they get put into another home, and then they get put into another home. And because the foster parents are treated really as sort of interchangeable parts, they start acting like interchangeable parts.
Right. They're like, we got a new one today.
Yeah. And the kids act like that, too. The kids feel like foster care is their fault. All of them do. And they feel like they've broken some sort of universal contract. You know, they've broken the family apart. They all feel like this.
On the other hand, you think it must be terribly wrenching when there is a strong attachment formed and
Right. Then
the child is taken back to be with the birth parent and that the foster parents sort of have no say in that.
What ideally would happen, and I think we're starting to see this more and more, you know, and this is one thing that I kind of want to stress, is that foster care is changing. It's a really vibrant and vital kind of world. It's not this sort of fait accompli, like, oh, it's a mess and it's stuck, because it's really changed. I mean, we really only have modern foster care as we know it, like since the 70s, you know. Child abuse was discovered in 1962, you know, so it's a really sort of new phenomenon,
right,
what we have, and it's been changing all the time. It's not just this stuck and terrible place. It really changes. And one of the things that's been changing is this idea that foster parents and biological parents can work together, and that when the child has attached to the foster parents, that then maybe when it works best, and I've seen some cases of this, the foster and biological parents then can share in the raising and loving of that child. Then that child has a lot of parents to care for him or her. It doesn't have to be this sort of entrenched battle.
Did you feel, I mean, this is such a tough topic.
Yeah.
Were you heartbroken the whole time you were working on this, or did you feel like there were moments of hope and joy? And
I did feel like there were a lot of moments of hope and joy. I felt like there was a woman named Mary Keene who took in kids that were much older after they'd aged out. One of the problems in the system is this aging out idea, where we just release kids after they're 18 or 21 into very few resources. And Mary Keene lives in Yonkers and takes in older kids, and she keeps them as long as they need. And we see tremendous resilience and creativity in those kids.
Yeah, I found that some of the most disturbing studies were about the aging out.
Yep.
And that you go from being sort of entirely controlled by this bureaucratic system to then having no supports or
right.
whatsoever.
And part of that is because we really saw, I mean, ASFA, which is the Adoption and Safe Families Act that passed in 97 under Clinton, that really changed the numbers. We brought the numbers down in foster care, which everyone celebrates. But what he required was that if you've been in foster care for the last 15 of 22 months, you need to be either adopted or sent back home, which is great. And that meant that the youngest kids, though, were getting adopted and sent back home, but the teenagers were not. So we've really shifted the numbers in foster care into being one of older children, and those older children are not being served. And I don't think the agencies have really caught up to this idea of who their population is. And they're really getting just sent off into nothing. And what they've primarily been given have been a bunch of classes.
Right.
Like, here's how to sign a check. Here's how to rent an apartment. What you need are people. You need human beings.
All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of really interesting stories and very big questions,
yeah.
many yet to be resolved. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
The book is To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care by Chris Beam, and it is reviewed in this week's issue by Benoit Denizet-Lewis, who calls it a remarkable new book. Thanks so much again, Chris.
Thank you.
This week, we have our third annual back-to-school issue featuring a broad range of children's books. And to talk about it, we have our new children's book editor, Sarah Smith. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Pamela.
So Sarah is the sixth children's book editor at The Times, and this is her first back-to-school issue. Tell us about what you have.
We have a wonderful range of books in this week's issue. Among them is a very charming review by Dan Yaccarino of books that will be inspiring to young artists, featuring characters who are crayons revolting against the child who uses them in boring ways, and a book about a Chinese artist who is an unsuccessful calligrapher and becomes one of China's greatest historical figures.
One of the things I loved about those books is that, unlike, there's so many books about for young children, particularly picture books about art. But in the case of these four books, they're really about the artist's tools. And there's one that's about the crayons and another about the paintbrush, and Matisse about his use of scissors once his eyesight started to go and he was no longer able to paint in the way he had during his youth, which I thought was a really interesting way to group the books together.
Yes, in a way, they're about how odd choices of materials can actually be inspiring to artists and, like Matisse, sort of bring them to different directions in their art.
And the idea behind the back-to-school issue is that Sarah and I are both parents of young children and know that this time of year is when parents and children are kind of worrying, excited, but also fretting about the new year. And these books and this issue is not so much about preparing for brushing up on math or your ABCs, but really about all of the social and emotional issues that go into coming back to school. And so in this particular group of books, there are a lot of novels that deal with some of the difficulties of high school and middle school.
That's right. We actually start with some bullying books for the youngest children. Very colorful and quite adorable picture books about bullying, featuring animals who don't really know how to behave properly in social situations, like bulls, for example, and naughty goats. And then moving through...
Feels a little less mean when it's just an animal.
That's
when they're furry.
Moving through middle school difficulties and then high school with some emphasis on the mean girl phenomenon.
And among the books for young adults, for high school readers, is one by Matthew Quick, right, who wrote the book that became the film Silver Linings Playbook.
That's right, beloved by my 11-year-old daughter, who I thought was a little young for the subject. But it just goes to show that even kids that little are thinking about these issues already.
Tell us about that book.
So Nathan Heller has written a great review of Matthew Quick's new novel, which is called Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock. And it's about a kid who is planning a murder suicide, and he gets pretty far along with his plan. And it's about his relationship with the teacher who leads his Holocaust history class, who sympathizes with him and really helps him out in a bind. And Mr. Heller, makes a great point about these kinds of books being useful to the next generation of kids as they're thinking about these things and maybe dealing with their anxieties about violence in schools, which they're seeing on TV.
And it's not the only book that's about serious issues. There's also a graphic novel about body image for girls.
That's right. We have a lovely graphic novel by Fanny Britt, a Canadian, with illustrations by Isabelle Arsenault, who won a New York Times Best Illustrated Award for the book that she illustrated called Migrant a few years ago. And this review by Taffy Broadesser Ackner is about how girls who are ostracized at school can find refuge in books and also in nature. And it's a lovely graphic novel, very, very sad in parts. Taffy said that she sort of sympathized with the subject because she herself had some social troubles in high school. But it's a great book and a sort of unusual treatment of it.
And it's not all heavy fare. There are also books about fun topics like lice in your hair or children who won't brush their hair.
That's right. We have some hilarious bookshelf entries. We have three sets of bookshelves, one on dinosaurs, one on some issues that kids might find going back to school, like, as you said, not wanting to brush their hair before school, the dreaded lice subject, and then just nervousness, too, about going back to school. So these picture books are not what we call sort of bibliotherapy. They're not just to make you feel good, but they're very charming and funny in their own right, and maybe a way of giving these subjects a little bit of air.
All right. Well, lots to read before assigned reading starts to weigh children down. Sarah Smith, our new children's book editor. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Pamela. I'm very excited to be here.
OK, okay, I have eaten my Twizzlers and am now ready. I've got energy. Parle Sagel is here with Bestseller News.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi. What's new on the list?
So it's a bit of a sleepy week in Bestseller Land. Everybody's sort of staying in place and there's not a lot of action. On the hardcover fiction list, J.K. Rowling continues to hold the top slot with her book Cuckoo's Calling, about a down-on-his-luck detective investigating supermodel suicide.
Are we not even going to use the name Robert Galbraith anymore?
Yeah, it's over.
All right.
It's over. At number two, James Patterson's thriller Mistress. And at three, we have something new. It's Rose Harbor and Bloom by Debbie McComber. Have you read her books?
I have not. I understand they are now a TV show.
They're a TV show. And she's also, like, she's called, you know, the reigning queen of women's fiction. She's 170 million books in print. And I kind of wonder how we've gotten away with not reading her. She writes these sort of cozy, very comforting books about, you know, this inn that people come back to and they have second chances. And recently, to sort of celebrate her new one, her publisher did something unusual. They invited, her publisher being Random House, they invited 400 women to this resort and had a weekend of like knitting and hanging out in tea and hanging out with Debbie and exchanging recipes. And
why aren't we at the Rose Harbor Inn, Parle?
I found
what are we doing here, talking on the podcast?
True. Like, part of me was just like, can you imagine Kafka doing something like this? And then I was just like, no, but I would like to do this. so, I mean, it's sort of like talking about the fact that for commercial women's fiction, there isn't a lot of review space. These books get passed along by word of mouth. So they were just sort of celebrating the fan community.
Is this the secret behind the husband's secret as well?
I think so. So the other two new entrants, and this is it, they're just three new books on the list, on hardcover fiction, are on the extended list. They are Last Kiss Goodbye by Karen Robards at number 18, which features a very sort of sexy female serial killer hunter. And appropriately at number 21, there's Let Me Go by Chelsea Kane. It's one of her Archie Sheridan novels featuring a serial killer femme fatale, Gretchen Lowell, who's just terrifying and alluring. And
one of our favorite contributors.
Yes. And, you know, Gretchen Lowell will never be found in Debbie McComber's territory, I have a feeling. On the nonfiction list, the only new book comes in at number one, and it's a new book by Mark Levin, the conservative radio host. It's called The Liberty Amendments, which calls on states to initiate 11 amendments to restore the country to what he calls its foundational principles. Twizzlers are involved, I think. and going down the list, we have Reza Aslan Zealot and Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In neck and neck, and there's a good mix of history, humor, and the occasional cat book.
All right, I'll see you at the Rose Harbor Inn.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pearl. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.